Bibles to Revelation chapter 14. We said this morning that Revelation chapter 14 was a very uplifting chapter. It's a chapter of contrast between chapters 12 and 13 versus chapter 14. It's a contrast between darkness and light, really, between the events of the tribulation period and actually the outcome of it. Things will be very dark for the people of God during the tribulation period, but they'll know the end from the beginning, and that's what we see here in chapter 14. In chapter 14, we have seven snapshots. We can call this the snapshots of the end times. It's like a photo album. It's not so much chronological as it is just certain snapshots that God has recorded for us so that we can see certain key points that we need to know at this time in our study. The first snapshot, the first vision, is found in verses 1 through 5. The second one is found in verses 6 through 7. The third is found in verse 8. The fourth is found verses 9 through 11. The fifth is 12 through 13. The sixth is found in verses 14, 15, and 16. And the final one is found in verse 17. Seven visions. And almost as I looked at that, reminded me of Zechariah's prophecy. There might be some correlation between the two, because in Zechariah's prophecy concerning the end time in Israel, he received eight visions in chapter 1 through 6 of Zechariah's prophecy. Let's read just the first one tonight. We want to look at the first one in detail tonight. It's found in verses 1 through 5, and it's the snapshot of the victory. The victory. Let's read it together. And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on Mount Zion. Notice the definite article. The lamb stood on the Mount Zion. And with him 144,000, having his father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. I heard the voice of harpers harping their harps. And they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn the song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. These are they that were not defiled with women, for they were virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being firstfruits unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. You'll have to excuse me. In Revelation chapter 12 and 13, we have a dark picture painted. We see a false lamb. We see him with a sickle. We see him reaping on the face of the earth. We see darkness as the two beasts are performing their ministry and as they are placing humanity under the curse of not being able to buy or sell and actually putting to death those who would not take the mark of the beast, who would not be identified with the number of the beast, which is the number of the man, 666. We saw in chapter 12 the place of Israel, and then in chapter 13 the place of the two beasts. And now in chapter 14 we're going to see the place of the true Lamb, the real Lamb of God. And what we're going to find out is this. Chapter 14 will show us the ultimate outcome. Now, it's important as we've been studying the book of Revelation to remember this. There are times when we hit verses that are chronological in their sequence. There are times when, as we did in chapter 6, we saw the seals and the seals opening. Then we saw the trumpets and the trumpets blasting. And then there are times when it stops and God will go back to eternity past, or he'll go back to some time in Israel's history, or he'll go back to some time or forward some to some time, and maybe even into the tribulation period, and give us little snapshots or pictures of the details. In other words, the moving chronological a flow is stopped, and then there are certain little snapshots so that you can stop and look at detail. If you've ever looked at movies like that and you want to stop, say, stop, hold it right there. They do it in football, they do it in other sports, and they're looking for details to pick them out. They'll say, wait, stop the film right there, move it back frame by frame until I tell you to stop, and then when you hit that frame, just keep it there till I can look at it. And what we find is this, that in Revelation chapter 14, that's what happens. We'll find seven visions, not necessarily in chronological order, but we'll find seven visions that God stops so that we can look at and pick apart the details to learn a lesson. And there's seven of them here. The first one is verses 1 through 5. And what it is this, the proclamation of the final victory. And we need to know this. We need to understand that it is in a what we call prolemic voice. Prolemic means simply this. It's going to happen in the future, but God uses a past tense as if it's already done. Because in God's eyes, future prophecy is as well as what? Completed. So when God writes prophetically, he writes in a past tense, and that is known as proleptic voice or proleptic tense. So what he's saying is this, it hasn't happened yet, but in God's eyes it has. And so, like verse 1 says, and I looked, and lo, the Lamb stood on Mount Zion. And what it is this, it's a future event, but it's happening as if it either took place or is taking place at that time. And yet it's still future. It's still prophetic. Now actually verses, this portion probably was one of the hardest to outline, to hang our thoughts on. There's so many different ways to look at it. We could look at it in three parts. One is the proclamation in verses 1 through 7. The proclamation in verses 1 through 7 could be broken down into two forms. We could say it's the proclamation of the final victory in verses 1 through 5, and the proclamation in 6 and 7 of the eternal gospel. Then in verses 8 through 14, we could say it's the pronouncement. And in this place, we see this. It's a pronouncement of judgment, first of all, verses 8 through 12, and then a pronouncement of blessing in verses 13 and 14. In other words, in verses 8 through 12, there'll be a pronouncement of judgment on Babylon and the followers of the beast. And then he'll follow that by a pronouncement of blessing. And then in verses 14 through 20, we could see that there is a preview, and it's of that last full and final great war, the War of Armageddon. We want to look at them a different way, though. We're going to look at them individually as the seven visions, but you can write that down. It might help you as you study. As we get to this portion, we find out this, that the world is broken down into two basic kinds of people. It's been said there is either saved or unsaved. It's been either said that there are saints and ain'ts. But I believe there are even more detail. There are two types of people. People whose mindset is now, and people whose mindset is one of I can wait for later. You remember in chapter 13, the beast will control their life. 13 verse 15 says he can kill them. He'll also control their food. In verse 17, it'll say this, they could neither buy nor sell. And what happens is the people living in that day are going to make a decision. Will I stand for the things I need now, or will I sacrifice even my life if need be for eternal things, that's God things, and be paid later? And really, that's just the way it falls in life. There are people who want everything now, give it to me now, I did it, I paid for it, I want it now. Or there are people that will sacrifice in this life because they're going to get something in the future. And what we're going to see in this chapter, which is really interesting, is they're going to take the here and now in the cup that the beast gives them as far as food and life in chapter 13. And then in verse 9, we're going to see this, that the Lord is going to give them in verse 10 a cup. They will take life and food now, but ultimately, guess what they will get? Look what verse 10 says. The same as who? Verse 9. The ones who worship the beast and put the mark in their forehead and hand. The same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without measure in the cup of his indignation, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of his holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. So what we find is this. There are really two types of people in the world. The people who want everything now, and that's a picture of the unbeliever, and the people who are willing to sacrifice now for eternal values. And that's what we see exactly taking place in this book. Let's look at it a little bit in verses 1 through 5. Notice it starts out with a phrase, "And I looked." I looked. This is a repetition that we see quite often here. It's a repetition of this, a vision. And what we see in Revelation 14:1 is, first of all, this, that there is a vision of the Lamb standing on Mount Zion. We have to identify this person. By the way, in verses 1 through 5, we're going to see this. We'll see the Savior, the sight, the seal, the song, their sanctification, and their sincerity. All in verses 5. That's what we'll look at tonight. And so the first thing we need to do is look at the Lamb and see, who is the Lamb? And by the way, that's an easy one, isn't it? And it's easy to find out who the Lamb is, because if you were a Jew, you would know in the Old Testament, as well as even from John the Baptist's ministry, that the Scripture, what did John the Baptist say? "Behold, the Lamb of God, which taketh away the sin of the world." And so we know this. It's easy for us to identify the Lamb. We've already been identified with the Lamb, or who the Lamb is. We won't go to all of them, but let me just, by way of review, remind you of what we've learned about the Lamb already. Look at Revelation chapter 5 for a second. In Revelation chapter 5 and verse 6, we've been introduced to the Lamb. And when we were here months ago, we learned this, that we got a vision of the Lamb crucified. So the first thing we learned about the Lamb in the book of Revelation is this, that in verse 6 of chapter 5, we saw the Lamb crucified. Verse 6 said, "And I beheld, and lo, in the midst of the throne of the four beasts, in the midst of the elders, stood a Lamb, as it had been freshly slain, standing, having the seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent forth into all the earth." So the first thing we learned about the Lamb is this, that he was crucified. Right away we know who the Lamb is. We've already been here. The Lamb is Jesus Christ. We're just teaching this so that you'll understand where we've been. Then the second thing we saw in verse 6, as well as 8, 12, and 13 is this. The Lamb was not only crucified, but the Lamb was glorified. Glorified. Remember it said this, a Lamb as it had been slain. What was he doing? He stood. He was standing. In verse 8, it said, "When he had taken the book, the four beasts and the 24 elders fell down." So we find him glorified. Verse 12 says basically the same thing. Verse 13 also the same thing. Then when we came to Revelation chapter 6, verses 1 through 16, we saw not only there was a Lamb crucified, not only do we see the Lamb glorified, but in chapter 6, verses 1 through 16, we see this. The Lamb was justified. Because in every one of the seals, we see God's justice being met out. Remember when we were in this portion, we said this? That the seals were man reaping what man had sown on this world. That the trumpets were man reaping from satanic activity. And that the vials were man reaping from the wrath of God being straightly outpoured. So here in chapter 6, when we see the first seal and the white horse with a rider dressed in white, and he had the crown upon his head, we find this, the false peace. We find them when they reject the true Prince of Peace, that they get false peace. And the first four seals are specifically that. Every aspect of Christ that they reject, they reap a false one. And the false one therefore brings in false peace. It brings in a famine. It brings in death. It brings in hardship. And so what we see is this. The Lamb is being justified by the breaking of those seals. Because man is getting simply what man wants. Man doesn't want Christ. Man doesn't want God's plan. The world system doesn't want. That's why the Jews said, "Away with us. Away with this man. We will not have this man to reign over us." And when they did, they had to reap the consequences of what they sowed. The biblical principle of Galatians 6 that says, "Whatsoever soweth a man, that shall he also reap," is a spiritual law that is just as concrete and just as firm as we have natural laws like gravity. Then when we came to chapter 7, and we were there, we saw the Lamb magnified. In chapter 7, verse 9, it says that, I beheld, and lo, a great multitude, which no man could number, of all the nations and kindreds and peoples and tongues, stood before the throne, before the Lamb, clothed with white robes. They had palms in their hands. Verse 10 says, they were crying with loud voice, salvation to our God, which sitteth upon the throne, and unto the Lamb. And so we see in verse 9, 10, and 14, and 17, they were magnifying the Lamb. They were lifting the Lamb up, and they were magnifying Him. Now, when we get to Revelation chapter 14, where we are this evening, we find this, that the Lamb is being rectified, that the wrongs are being made right. And in it, we find the full flow of history for the Lamb. We find Him crucified, glorified, justified, magnified, rectified. We find everything that God has prophesied in the Old Testament come to a conclusion in Revelation chapter 14 in this little snapshot, verses 1 through 5, of the full and final victory. And so for us to identify who the Lamb is no problem. We know this, the Lamb is the Lord Jesus Christ. Now I want to say something again, just briefly by introduction, about the comparison of Revelation chapter 14 to chapters 12 and 13. If the book of Revelation was to have omitted, if the Spirit of God was to have omitted chapter 14, we would have a lot of unanswered questions in our minds. For instance, in Revelation 13, 15, we find the saints of God being killed because they wouldn't take the mark. Now, if we didn't have chapter 14, the first question in our mind would be this. What happened to them after they died? In other words, what was their final outcome? When we get through chapter 14, in verse 13, we see this, and I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth, yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, and their works do follow them. So we find this, their death wasn't in vain, their death wasn't futile, that they're going into their rest, and they're blessed because they died for the testimony of the Lord, and their life wasn't wasted because their works follow with them. So that answers that question. In chapter 13, in verse 11, we find this, there's a false Lamb. That raises a question to my mind, is there a real Lamb? So in chapter 14, 1, we find this. There is a real Lamb. And by the way, the real Lamb is going to be victorious. In Revelation chapter 13, verses 12 and 14, we find this. There's great deception. The world will be deceived. Raises a question, doesn't it? The question in my mind would be this. Is everybody in the world at that time deceived? When we get to chapter 14, verse 6 and 7, it says this. I saw another angel flying about. And that angel had the everlasting gospel to preach. And it was preached to them that dwell on the earth of every kindred, nation, tongue, and people, saying with a loud voice, fear God, give glory to Him, the hour of His judgment is come, worship Him that made heaven and earth and sea and the fountains of the earth. And so we find this, that the gospel is going out, not everybody will be deceived. So that answers that question. In chapter 13, verse 11, we find this, the false Lamb has a sickle and he's reaping. And boy, he looks victorious, didn't he, when we looked at that. He is going through and he is judging on the earth. But when we get to chapter 14, verses 14 through 16, we'll find this, he doesn't have the last sickle. He doesn't have the last judgment. Because what we find is this, the true Lamb comes forth and he has the last judgment. That's why in John chapter 5, the Lord said himself that all judgment is given unto the Son of Man. And the hour is coming when they that are dead in the grave, whether great or small, shall hear his voice. And they that have done good will come forth to judge to the judgment of life and be given life, the resurrection of life. And they that have done wrongly, have done evil, to the resurrection of judgment and damnation. And so we find that God will have the last. In Revelation 13, 14, we found out that the prophet was busy. The prophet had his ministry. He was deceiving. We would ask this question. What happens to the false prophet? Is there judgment for his false for the false prophet? In chapter 14, verse 8, we find this. Babylon the great is fallen. And Babylon, we're going to find out, is this another name for that false prophet's system. So a system falls, the people that followed him fall, judgment comes in. In chapter 13, verse 16, we found this. There was a beast, number one. Is there judgment for him? And what we find is, verses 9 through 10 will tell us that the wrath of God is coming against them that worship the beast and the beast himself. And so we find out that there's judgment there. The final question, if we didn't have chapter 14, would be this. Will rebellion be allowed to continue? You see, the great lesson of Revelation chapter 13 was this, that God allows in his system rebellion. But he doesn't allow the results to be avoided. In other words, he gives men the freedom to rebel, but he doesn't give men the freedom to avoid the consequences of the rebellion. And so in the rebellion in chapter 13, the question will come about with this. Would God and is God going to allow the rebellion to continue? And the answer is no. In chapter 14, verses 14 through 20, we're going to see that judgment is going to come upon the face of the earth. The sickle is going to be swinging and rebellion is going to be subdued. And God's plan will come into fruition. So there's a great comparison between these two chapters. It's almost like the way that the Apostle Paul wrote the book of Romans. In the book of Romans, he starts out and he says that all have sinned. He looks in chapter 1 and he says, look at those ungodly, lost people. And they would say, yes, they're lost, they're ungodly, they're worthy of God's judgment. Then he says in chapter 2, verse 1, you, the moral man, who now are saying, yes, he is worthy to be judged, are condemned because you do the same things and you show by your judging you have a standard and you can't even keep it. And then he says to the Jew who would be sitting back finally and saying, yeah, they both deserve it, but I'm a Jew, I'm the child of God. Then he turns to them and he says, you're guilty too. You've had light. You've had the oracles of God. You've had the word of God. You've had the history of God dealing with his people. You're guilty too, and all have sinned. And then in the darkness of that backdrop of the depth of sin, he holds up the doctrine of salvation. That's what he does here. In the tribulation period, what he said God simply does is paint the blackness of the background of man's sin, of the two beasts, of their ministry, of their deception, of their death. And then what he's going to do in chapter 14, 1, he's going to say this, now look at the victory of the Lamb. In the midst of the full satanic outpouring, in the midst of the beast one and beast number two and all of their deception on the earth, God's plan is fully and finally realized. Their God is never ever overthrown by the rebellion. God's plan in chapter 14 will come into fruition. And that's what we see in chapter 14, verse 1. And so in verse 1, when we see the vision of victory, what we see in verse 1 is this, that the vision, lo, I looked, John's going to say he had a vision. He looked and he saw. And lo, a lamb stood on Mount Zion. Now we need to stop a little bit, as we normally do as we move through here, and do a little bit of a typical study as far as it comes to Mount Zion. Turn with me, please, first to 1 Chronicles chapter 11. 1 Chronicles chapter 11. It's amazing to me as I pick up commentaries, and by the way, the book of Revelation probably as well as Hebrews and Romans, those three books have more commentaries written on them by more people available in a bookstore than any other book of the Bible. And what we find is that there are more conflicting views on this book than any other one. One of them is Mount Zion. Is this the literal Mount Zion, the geographical one? Or is this one the heavenly one? And what we find is great men have argued over the years and differed over what it is. First thing we need to do is establish this. Is there such a place as a geographical, actual piece of land in the world known as Mount Zion? That's what we have to establish. First of all, in 1 Chronicles chapter 11, in verse 4, it says, and David and all of Israel went to Jerusalem, which is Jebus, where the Jebusites were, and the inhabitants of the land. And the inhabitants of Jebus said to David, Thou shalt not come hither. Nevertheless, David took the castle of Zion, which is the city of David. What we see here is there's a geographical place known as the Castle of Zion. It is found, it is known, God says it is the city of David, and it was in the territory controlled by the name of Jebus. That's where we get Jebusites or Jebusites from. That's where the people were named after their head. And what we find is this, that David comes there, and David overtakes that geographical place. It's really on the map. Now, Zion, therefore, has a unique place on the maps as far as geography is concerned, because it is Zion, and its unique feature, that God promised he will install or use that geographical land for his Messiah. Look with me for a second to Psalm 2. Psalm 2. I don't think there's any single book in the Bible that talks about Zion more than the Psalms do. And you know why that is? Because the hope of the Jew was the promise that God had made to Israel to install their king in the kingdom promised to them, to install him in that land called Mount Zion. Mount Zion. In Psalm 2, we have just that promise. That promise is brought out in verse 6. Says, Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. Now remember what I told you about the proleptic voice? It's happened, but it really hasn't. In Psalm 2, we have this in verse 1, the rebellion of the nations against God's plan. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? Why do the kings of the earth set themselves to battle against the Lord, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his, see the word anointed in the Hebrew? His Christ. His Christ. And what we find is this, that the Christ and is fitting into the plan of God, and the people in the world rebel against God's plan in using his anointed. Verse 3, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh, and the Lord shall have them in derision. Then shall he speak unto them in his wrath, and speak to them and vex them in his sore displeasure. Listen, the rebellion comes the first time, so he comes in his second coming to vex them. That's the tribulation period and the return of the Lord. He'll have them then in derision, and verse 6 says this, at that time he has set and he'll install is Christ in Mount Zion. And so the psalmist says simply this, that in God's plan, he would send the Christ. He would send the Lamb. The Lamb would be rejected. The Lamb would be tried to be overthrown. The Lamb would be rebelled against. But God will laugh. God will have them in derision because he will come in a coming day and in his sore displeasure, that's the tribulation period of the time of Jacob's trouble that we're seeing the day of the Lord in the book of Revelation, and he will sorely displease them and vex them. And at that time, he will establish the kingdom on earth and set his anointed in Zion. Look at Psalm 48 for a second. Psalm 48 verse 2. Verse 1 says, Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, in the mountain of his holiness. Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion on the sides of the north in the city of the great king. So he mentions Mount Zion again. Why? Because it says there that they go there to rejoice. Great is the Lord, great to be praised in the city of our God, that's Mount Zion, and in the mountain of his holiness, that's the Lord's dwelling place, that's Mount Zion. Look at Psalm 132 for a second. Verse 12, we'll actually look at verse 11. The Lord hath sworn in truth to David, he will not turn from it. Of the fruit of thy body will I set upon thy throne. Here the psalmist says this. Remember what God said to David. God made a promise to David. You know what it was? That I would place a throne in Zion, and upon that throne I will have a king and a kingdom. Verse 12, if thy children will keep my covenant and my testimony that I shall teach them, their children shall also sit upon the throne forevermore. Verse 13, for the Lord hath chosen Zion. He hath desired it for his habitation. Now let me ask a question. As soon, we saw in chapter 12, as soon as God does something through Israel, what does the devil do? He opposes it. So what do you think happens as soon as God says, I have sworn and counseled to David that a king shall sit on the throne, that throne will be located in a chosen piece of land known as Zion? What do you think the devil would do? He'd put another throne there. Why do you think for centuries the battle has taken place, sometimes rightly, wrongly, for that piece of property known as Jerusalem? Why? Why do you think the mosque of Omer is there right now, on the place where the temple is? Because that place has God's name written on it. God took a stamp and said this, this is my place. In a coming day, I will fulfill a promise to David. I will put a king on his throne. He will enter into a kingdom, and his kingdom will go from an earthly one and issue into an eternal kingdom, and that kingdom shall have no end. So in Psalm 132:13, we see the same thing. Look for a second to Isaiah, the book of Isaiah chapter 2. Not only does Zion have a unique feature that God has chosen it, but as already mentioned, it has a lot to do with the prophecies concerning the future. Zion will play a very important part in the future of Israel. In Isaiah chapter 2, look at verses 1 through 5. And the word that Isaiah the son of Amoz saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. And it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all the nations shall flow onto it. Now this is in the millennial time, after the time we're seeing. In other words, after the tribulation period. Verse 3, and many people shall go and say, come ye, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, and the house of God of Jacob, and he will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths. And out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge among the nations and shall rebuke many people. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. O house of Jacob, come ye and let us walk in the light of the Lord. And what we see is Isaiah 2 tells us that in a coming day, known as a millennial kingdom, there'll be an earthly kingdom set up, and the nations of the world will gather together and travel to Jerusalem, to Mount Zion in particular, because God has put his name there, and he will set up his kingdom there. Look over in chapter 1. In chapter 1, verse 21, we see, though, there's a problem. What we see is this. As soon as God places his name, we would venture to say this. If we could open a book of this Bible and see your name written there where it said something like, I, the Lord, say that I will use and put your name there tomorrow in a very mighty way, that guess what? There'd be a conflict. There would be a very great spiritual conflict. And it's just proof that there's an adversary. So as soon as God says, Zion has my name, Zion has a place in the future, guess what's going to happen? Well, look at verse 21 of chapter 1. How is the faithful city become a harlot? It is full of judgment. It was full of judgment. Righteousness lodged in it. But now, murderers. Thy silver is become dross, thy wine mixed with water. The princes are rebellious and companion of thieves. Everyone loves gifts and follows after rewards. They judge not the fatherless, neither doth they cause the widow come unto them. Therefore the Lord of hosts, the mighty one of Israel, saith, Ah, I will ease me of mine adversaries and avenge me of my enemies. Verse 27, Zion shall be redeemed with judgment and her converts with righteousness. Now listen, next to that verse, verse 27, you need to write Jacob's trouble. Tribulation period. Because that verse is saying this, once God put his name on Zion, once God said she's unique in my plan, the devil steps in and corrupts her, causes the faithful city to become a harlot. But God says this, I'm going to redeem her. I'm going to redeem her with what? Judgment. Judgment. And that's what we've just been seeing in the book of Revelation in the tribulation period, that God will bring about out of the tribulation period his people purified and the nations judged. And as we move our way back, look at Zechariah for a second. Another important event that's going to take place there is the Lord's return. In Zechariah chapter 14 and verse 4, it says, and his feet shall stand on that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives will cleave in the midst thereof towards the east and towards the west. And there shall be a great valley, and half the mountain shall be removed towards the north and half of it towards the south. And what we find is this, when the Lord comes back at the end of that tribulation period, he will stand on the Mount of Olives. Now look at chapter 14 for a second. Look at Revelation chapter 14, verse 1. It says this, and I looked, and can you believe it? Lo and behold, I saw the Lamb, the Christ, God's anointed, standing on the Mount Zion. You know what he's saying? He's saying, I can't hardly believe it. It's going to really happen. The Lamb's coming back, and he's going to stand on that mountain. Just like Psalm 2:6 said, just like Isaiah 2 said, just like Isaiah 1:25 said, God will redeem it. He will be there, and so will the redeemed. You know, the millennial kingdom is going to be such a tremendous kingdom. You know why? Because as we've read in Isaiah, there's going to be a time of peace. But listen, the Lord will dwell there. I believe that the apostles will have a part there in the judgment of the nations on the 12 thrones. I believe the redeemed have a part there. I believe this, that the Old Testament saints have a promise of having a part there. And there will be earthly people who have never died yet, who are physical, just like you and me today, and who will have unglorified bodies who have not yet died. And they're going to go into the kingdom, Matthew 24 says, so that you're going to have a blending of glorified, redeemed, and those still in their flesh, and God's presence in the Lamb. What a wonderful mixture. It's going to be a tremendous time. Well, listen, we've just been through chapter 12, the great conflict. We've just been through chapter 13, the two beasts and their tremendous ministries. But what God does is say, now stop for a second. Don't get depressed. My plan's going to work. And so John takes a snapshot and says this, look, and I beheld, and can you believe it? Lo and behold, I saw the Lamb standing with the redeemed, the 144,000 chosen, standing on that Mount Zion. Can you believe it? And I believe this, that this is a physical Mount Zion because of the definite article in the plan and prophecy. Now, I am not contesting the fact that Hebrews 12:22 says that there is a heavenly Jerusalem, and that's the one we're going to. And in that heavenly Jerusalem, there is called a Mount Zion there. It's a heavenly Mount Zion. But I'm saying this, there it is qualified and clarified as being heavenly. All the other places where it's just simply the Mount Zion, it's this, the geographical mount. And I believe the greatness of this snapshot is this, that this 144,000 that were sealed back in chapter 7, who are serving all the way through the tribulation period, finally get there where God has promised them, on that mountain, there's the Lamb with them, and God has got a big banner saying, the victory is mine. In other words, beast, do your thing. You, Antichrist, do your thing. Satan, the dragon, do your thing. You have your sickle. You have your ministry. You shed your blood. You persecute my people. But in the end, the ultimate victory is the Lord's. Remember we said this morning about spiritual depression, Psalm 42 and 43? You got to keep your eyes where? on the Lord, off yourself, off your circumstances, and where? In the future, because the future gives us hope. The first snapshot is a picture of the future. Could you imagine what it's going to be like when that desolation of abomination of desolation takes place in the middle of that 7-year time period, when they have to flee on the wings of that great eagle because the beasts are trying to kill them, when it says, except those days be short, no flesh would dwell, and they open up the scriptures and they look at this and they see the first snapshot is this: we're going to get there one day. God's taking a picture. The Lamb is there. Behold, 144,000 are there. And I agree with Lehman Strauss. I do not believe that this 144,000, like some people do, is a different group of people who are heavenly. The first ones in chapter 7 are earthly. They have two different ministries. These are the same 144,000 that were sealed. These are not the church. These are not glorified people in the church age. It can't be, because, listen, it says that these were the ones who went through the tribulation period. These are the ones who were not defiled of women. They were virgins. These were Jews who were sealed, had the mark of God. They got it in chapter 7. And listen, in chapter 7, they were sealed in the beginning. In chapter 14, 1, they're there in the end. And God doesn't lose one of them. Doesn't lose any of the church either. I believe the church is in here, but I mean, we've got a different place. But listen, the 144,000 and the Lamb are standing on Mount Zion. Let me just show you for a second. Let me just read to you. You don't need to turn to it. But this is what Joel talked about in Joel 2. Listen to this. In Joel 2:32, this is the prophecy. It says this: and it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be delivered. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem shall be deliverance. And the Lord hath said, in the remnant whom the Lord shall call. Joel prophesied. He said, look, in that day, by the way, the verse in front of that is the verse they use today about speaking in tongues. It talks about the Spirit is poured out. It talks about the sun and moon being darkened and all that. What he's saying is this: in that day, at the end of the day of the Lord, what's going to happen is this: Zion will be redeemed. There'll be deliverance in Zion. There'll be salvation in Zion, and people from all over the earth shall come. Now that takes us to the next point. And really, we just touch on it rather quickly. And that's their song. It says this. We know verse 2. We don't have to spend much time on it, because verse 2 is a repetition of what we've heard over again. It says, I heard a voice, singular, from heaven as the voice of waters. That's the voice of God. And he's heard this. He heard the harpers harping. When I read that, sometimes I chuckle, because that's what we talk about when wives are giving their husbands a little pecking, you know. Quit harping on me. But really, it's a scriptural term, isn't it, ladies? You can actually look at your husband and say, look, this is scriptural, dear, because he even heard the sounds of harpers harping. So you can do that too. In verse 3, it says this: and they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders, and no man could learn the song. Circle this. But those 144,000 which were redeemed at that time from the earth. Now, this teaches us a principle, and the principle is simply this: every spiritual experience is individual. Individual. You know, the psalmist, and this chapter has so much to do with the Psalms, the psalmist repeats over and over again this: sing a new song unto the Lord. What do you think he means by that? I'll tell you what it is shortly. We'll look at it next week, because time has run out. Every time the psalmist had an experience with the Lord, whether good or whether bad, at the end of that experience, he says, that experience causes me to do what? Sing. And because it was a new experience, guess what kind of a song it is? A new song. So in the book of Revelation, you find this: the church in heaven around the throne, they were saved by the blood of the Lamb, they sing a new song. Their new song is because they experienced redemption by the blood of Christ. They experienced the graces of being in the church age. Their song is a new song. And by the way, the angels can't sing their song, right? Why? They didn't experience it. Well, listen, the ones going through the tribulation period are going to go through an experience so personal that when it's done, it says this: and they sing a new song too. And no man could sing it but them. Why? Because every spiritual experience is personal and cannot be transformed. And that's the difficult thing about our relationships being so individual and having such a personal aspect. That's why 1 Corinthians chapter 2 says this, "What knoweth what is in a man except the spirit of that man that is in him?" You know, it's funny sometimes when I talk to people and I try to convey to them, they'll ask questions like, "Oh, you were in Vietnam, what was it like?" And you tell them, and it's kind of like, "Oh, that's nice." But to you, it's real. It's like women, it's like, explain to somebody the experience of having a child. Explain that to your husband. He's never had one. Right? I remember when my son was born. You know, it was back in the days where you couldn't be in the hospital. You had to wait down in the waiting room. Then they called you up after the child was born. My wife was up there for 6 hours. They call you up there. You've never had, I never carried that child. I never had the baby kick in my stomach. I never had any personal experience with that child. I went running up to see Jesse, and the doctor said, "Here's your son," and he held him to my chest. I said, "What do I do with him?" He said, "Put your arms around him." The first thing the wife says is, "Don't you love him? Why won't you hold him?" Well, it's not my experience. You see, what we see is this, every experience, especially in life, whether it's physical, emotional, or spiritual, is yours personal. And you cannot convey the fullness of that experience to even your wife or your husband. It's so personal. But listen, that experience should cause in your life a devotional response of singing, because it has taught you something new about the Lord. That is what is known as a new song. So when we get together next time, we'll show you. We'll go through the Psalms. You'll see every time the psalmist had an experience, at the end of that experience, he'll say, "Now sing that new song to the Lord." Just sing it back, what you went through and what the Lord did and what he taught you. Why is it a new song? Because it was a new experience. I believe this. I believe we as Christians should learn to enjoy to sing. Listen, the man that led me to the Lord, when we would go traveling together, he'd sing in the shower. He'd sing at home. He'd sing at work. He would drive people crazy, drive in his truck. He'd stop at a light with his windows down. You'd hear him singing a hymn. We should sing. We should be singing people. Why? Because every experience is personal. It teaches something about the Lord. It should evoke that response in our hearts. And listen, in the tribulation period, that 144,000, they're going to do the same thing. They're going to go through such an experience. But when they're done, listen, and they stand before that Lamb, and they get there in the promised land, and their feet are on that Mount Zion, listen, you don't realize what they're going to sing. We're going to sit around and enjoy it. They're going to sing great. Let's pray.